everyone, and welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal, filling in for Tanzina today. It's great to be here. Today we start in Baltimore, Maryland, where a bizarre literary scandal of sorts is bringing a lot of unwanted attention to the administration of Mayor Catherine Pugh.
I want to say at the start, I understand the objections of, and some of the concerns of many, and I sincerely want to say that I apologize that I've done something to upset the people of Baltimore.
Since 2011, Pugh has reportedly received at least $800,000 from a number of groups, including the University of Maryland Medical System and healthcare provider Kaiser Permanente. Those payments were made in exchange for a series of children's books written and self-published by Pugh called Healthy Holly. Pugh didn't publicly disclose the deals at the time, and now reporters are finding it hard to track down where these thousands of books actually ended up. For Baltimore, the revelations about Mayor Pugh represent the latest breach of trust in the institutions that are supposed to keep a big city up and running. Joining us now are Alec McGillis, a reporter for ProPublica, and Liz Bowie, a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Alec, Liz, nice to have you on.
Thank you.
Hi.
Liz, I want to start with you. This scandal centers on a series of children's books, but also fairly serious accusations of corruption concerning its author, the mayor of Baltimore. What exactly is this all about?
I think what's interesting and what has gotten the attention of so many people about this story is that it's actually very simple. The mayor sold $800,000 worth of books to various groups in the city. The major buyer was the University of Maryland Medical System, but she's also sold books to Kaiser Permanente, to other individuals. For instance, a prominent businessman who yesterday we found out had written her a check for $100,000 for one book. The questions that have been raised is, what did those individuals who bought books get in return? Because not all of the books have been printed, apparently, although we haven't been able to track all of them down. And the other question is, was there a conflict of interest? In other words, in some cases, the institutions that bought the books also had either legislation they wanted passed or had contracts with the city that were under review at the time they purchased the books. The books themselves are not in our public libraries. They are not part of any curriculum. And we've gone to publishing houses and book agents who say they would never have been published by a reputable publishing house. To be clear, these are 20-page paperbacks with awkward illustrations.
And what's the nature of that wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing?
Well, there are now six investigations into what's happened, and I'm sure there will be more. The most serious is being conducted by the state prosecutor at the bequest of Governor Larry Hogan. And they will be looking at that group. The state prosecutor only looks at basically political corruption. But there are also investigations by the city council, by the University of Maryland Medical System, and by the Board of Ethics. I should say the mayor has been very sick. She was hospitalized with pneumonia last week. And once she got out of the hospital, she held a press conference on Thursday in which she showed documentation that 60,000 books had been printed and delivered to the school system, which actually didn't ask for the books. But in any event, she has said almost nothing since then.
Alec, please help us understand the backdrop against which this is playing out. You wrote a recent piece in the New York Times Magazine that places what we're now seeing with Mayor Pugh as just the latest slip up in a much bigger citywide breakdown. When did these troubles start?
What we're seeing here in Baltimore the last few years is a really kind of extraordinary general institutional breakdown, kind of an unraveling that has been happening in the city, starting most clearly right after the death of Freddie Gray from injuries that he got in police custody in 2015 and the protests and unrest that followed his death. After that event, which got a lot of worldwide attention, we've had this unbelievable surge in violence in the city. Baltimore's always been a violent city, of course, but we'd actually seen our homicide rate dropping quite considerably in the years prior to that. We got under 200 one year in 2011. We've now spiked for four straight years. We've been over 300 homicides. We had more homicides in the city a couple years ago than all of New York City, which is 14 times larger than Baltimore. That's just extraordinary. We're basically the only city in the country that has returned to early 1990s levels of violence, back in the crack era. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we've had an unbelievable police corruption scandal that unfolded the last couple years, just mind-boggling levels of corruption in this one plainclothes unit in the police department. We've had an endless cycle of police commissioners, about one per year, cycling in and out the last few years. And then just this general sense of a void of leadership in City Hall, just really struggling to sort of get its hands on this violence and exert any real sense of authority. And then on top of that, now you have this just wild scandal coming out with these children's books. So it really is kind of it's a breakdown in order and governance. One thing to understand about Baltimore is that for all of Baltimore's, longstanding troubles that we all know about, incredible blight and suburban flight and disinvestment and all of that, the city actually is doing okay economically. This is not a story about total economic collapse like you saw in Detroit around the time of the recession where, a city goes into total bankruptcy and just kind of falls apart economically. That's not what's going on here. This is a collapse of order and governance.
How was Mayor Pugh doing before this story broke out?
I wouldn't say that she was a wildly popular mayor. She had had all of these sort of issues with the police department that had come out.
Mayor Pugh is up for re-election next year. There'll be a primary next spring. That'll be the decisive election. And there had been talk about her having fairly strong prospects for re-election. She had raised quite a bit of money. There hadn't been any real announced strong challengers yet to her. And so it was looking like she might be able to kind of ease into a second term despite not being all that popular, really. One important thing about her to keep in mind is that she won election last time with a very narrow win over a prior mayor, someone who served two mayors previous to her, who had herself been forced out of office over ethics and corruption charges. Which charges that now, held up against what's happening now actually look relatively smaller scale just in terms of the sheer amount of money involved. So there's sort of a tragicomic element to this where Baltimore is now once again dealing with these issues after having elected someone basically because she was not that prior mayor who was also dealing with ethics issues.
I think one of the fascinating issues here is that the scandal extends so far beyond Mayor Pugh and into the community of business leaders and charities. And so we think that there's a lot of tentacles here that extend well beyond the mayor.
Alec, you wrote in your recent piece that it's hard to describe Baltimore's, quote, unraveling, and that the national political discourse lacks a vocabulary for the city's ills. What do you mean by this?
What I mean by that is that there's been a lot of attention nationally these last few years to the whole issue of police reform and dealing with excessive policing, police brutality, police harassment of citizens, especially African-American ones. And that's been a very necessary conversation because of all the events we saw happening around the country in, Ferguson and Cleveland and Staten Island and elsewhere in the 2014-15 range. But what Baltimore's actually been dealing with these last few years on the policing front is actually sort of the inverse of excessive policing. There's pretty widespread consensus here in the city that one big reason for this incredible surge of violence that we've had has been essentially a pullback by the police that has left a lot of neighborhoods, especially the city's very heavily segregated black neighborhoods, exposed to crime and violence and create a kind of negligence by the police, by the authorities in these neighborhoods. So where the problem of equal protection is not just refraining from harassment and brutality in certain neighborhoods, but it also is a problem of simply not providing good policing and protection in certain neighborhoods. And that has been sort of lost in this nationwide debate around police reform. It's been a conversation about how do we rein in the police when, in fact, what Baltimore has been dealing with these last couple of years is sort of the opposite form of official negligence.
Are we still witnessing the aftermath of that situation now?
It's evolved. Initially, after Freddie Gray's death and the charges by the district attorney, there was great upset among the police over those charges, the feeling that it was inappropriate to bring those charges because, in fact, very little was known about exactly what had happened to cause Freddie Gray's death in the back of that police van. And so there was this great sense of aggrievement over six of their colleagues having been charged. And there was what's really now is hard to deny a pullback by the police in those initial months. Those months saw this incredible spike in violence. We were up over 40 homicides a month in those first few months in the spring of 2015. And the reasons given for that pullback evolved then over the next couple of years into all the uncertainty around what is known as the consent decree. The city is now facing a federal consent decree where it's basically agreed with the Department, U.S. Department of Justice to reform its police department. A federal judge is enforcing that consent decree. And there are basically new guidelines around how the police need to conduct themselves. And there's been great uncertainty among the police around just what that means they are still allowed to do and not do in carrying out their jobs of policing. It's a real uncertainty because they've basically gotten very little guidance in these last couple of years over what this consent decree means. They've had this endless cycle of commissioners. There's been no real training. And so the police have been left unsure of what they can still do and are basically dealing with that uncertainty by, in a lot of cases, not getting out of their cars. And there's just endless stories about police sitting in their cruisers, scrolling through their phones, and not actually getting out and policing, whether it's, you know, confronting a whole bunch of young men on the corner who may or may not be selling drugs, that sort of thing. And so there has just been this continuing sense that we have a police force that is not fully engaged in policing.
It was seen as a real abdication of duty, wasn't it?
Exactly. That's what's been kind of lost in a lot of this ongoing debate around police reform, that we do have to worry about the sort of irresponsibility and an official abuse of power that comes with excessive policing, but we also have to worry about police simply not doing their job that they're paid to do. And recognize that there's also an issue of equal protection on that score. There's so many residents I spoke to and heard from in reporting my article in the New York Times Magazine who just talk about their incredible sense of fear in these neighborhoods and their desire to have police doing good policing in their communities.
Yeah, I mean, I would also add that one of the deep problems with the police department right now is that there aren't enough officers. They've had a difficult time attracting them and training them. And so part of the problem, people believe, is that there just aren't enough officers on the street and not enough backup for police officers who are trying to do their best.
Alec McGillis is a reporter for ProPublica, and Liz Bowie is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal, filling in for Tanzina Vega. Stick with us. A lot more to come.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.